interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
So that's when I had to make the decision. Do I jump out of this window in this mental hospital, or do I wait for this hospital staff to come beat my ass? And that's when I decided I should probably jump out the window. And that's when I later on begot a cable access television show about being a neo-Nazi.
So just like that. And how old were you when you had to make that decision
to jump out of the window? 16 years old. I was in Terre Haute, Indiana. I was on the run from the law in Philly. I had a warrant for my arrest in Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey. I was 15 or 16, because I was a tri-state kind of guy. So I had warrants there, and I was running from the law, and I was living in Indiana. And somehow I got to go stay with a crazy story, man. I'm living in a safe house. A legitimate safe house. Everyone that lives in this place in Indiana is wanted in their part of the country. And there's like guys from like all over the country, all these like militia dudes and shit popping in and out. It's crazy, guns and shit everywhere. And so I'm 16 years old, ran out of money already and was fucking bored out of my life. So I used to sneak out at night, and we were supposed to keep the place really down low. You know what I mean? So no really going outside much. Right. But I'm a fucking 16 year old badass, you know, just I got to break rules wherever I go, even at the safe house. I'm climbing out the window at night like you with your parents, you know?
Yeah.
And so anyway, I finally get a job. I was walking around at night one night. And I came across the guy in the morning setting up to do concrete work. I just walked over and said, "Yo, I need some money. You know, you need some help." And he's like, "Yeah, I'll give you a job." And I worked for him. He liked the way I work. He was not a racist dude. He was actually a really funny dude. He was this big pothead guy. And so he would smoke weed at work, right? And I was the neo-Nazis I ran with. You weren't allowed to do no drugs. You know, there's just those set of guys, because it was more like Timothy McVeigh shit going on, right? So we didn't do drugs and shit. Alcohol was big, but no drugs allowed. So anyway, he would sit there and he smoked weed, and he loved Oprah Winfrey too. And so he would smoke weed, and he'd ask me if I know, it was great. And he'd be like, "Oh, you want a hit of this weed, you know?" And I'd be like, "Nah, man, that shit's killing the white race." And he used to go just like this. "Yeah, I own a business. You're fucking homeless. I'm going to the white race." Good one, Frank. So here we go. Right? So that boss, he liked me so much. He would drive me between safe houses from. I had a crew in Indiana, in the Apos that I was living at. And I had a place in Springfield, Illinois, and I was going back and forth between the two groups. I really liked the Springfield group of neo-Nazis because they were all younger and none of them were wanted. They like high school kids, like my age, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was like really enjoying it. And they had girls and hung out with them all the time. I mean, come on. I mean, 16.
Right.
So so anyway, this boss would drive me to either place sometimes. He was a really good dude. He lived in Terre Haute, Indiana. Anyhow, one night he says, "Can I take you to my apartment? And I'm going to drop you off, and I'm going to go over to my girl's house. And then in the morning, I'm going to come get you, and I'll drive you to your friends in Springfield, wherever you want to go, you know?" And so I said, "Sure." And now I'm a full-blown alcoholic. Just know I'm I grew up in an all-Irish Catholic neighborhood in Philly. Not knocking my neighborhood, but, I mean, there's a lot of us that are drunks and alcohol. And so it's in my blood. And I'm very bad alcoholic already at 17, 16. So anyway, the guy buys me a case of beer because I was a worker for him. He never even thought of my age. I had a big swastika on my neck, so people didn't really ask my age much. You know what I mean? I'm just kind of guy just let go. Like, whatever. So anyway, he bought me a case of beer, man. I went up in that apartment. I got all drunk. And as I'm drinking these beers, man, I start just thinking I was running on a fake name, obviously, because I was wanted. Mm-hmm. My boss doesn't know my real name. Like, nobody knows my real name. I'm in Terre Haute, Indiana. I'm a Philly kid who hasn't talked to my family in fucking months. I've been running in these neo-Nazi crews for months without popping my head up for a while just because of safety reasons and shit. And, just fucking lonely and sad, depressed. I mean, I'm a kid and got all drunk, big bad neo-Nazi I was, and got all drunk and just thought it'd be a better idea to end my life, you know? And I tried to cut my wrist in this apartment. Mm-hmm. So here comes the police because my boss left me at his apartment. Now, my neighbor's never seen me before. Now, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm all drunk, stumbling out on the back porch, all drunk, cut up, all covered in blood. and they think I killed the guy upstairs. Like, they think I'm a murderer. So they call the police. The Terre Haute police show up, you know, they're banging on the door. I'm doing the whole, you know, nobody's home, leave me alone. And, you know, in come the boys, and they're screaming, where's the dead body? They were looking for a dead body. They thought I killed my boss, right? Or whatever. So they were like, where's the body? I'm like, they just see me covered in blood. So they're just like, what the fuck is wrong? You know? So I'm like, you know, I'm like, you know, and they see I tried to kill myself, whatever. They take me to a mental hospital. In that time, I don't have an ID. I'm only 16 anyway. But when they were asking me my name, I was given this fake name that I had been giving out since I left Philly. You know, I tried to keep with one alias, you know. And so I give it to them, and they're like, whatever, take me to this mental hospital. Sometime in me sobering up that day and talking to the hospital, I gave them my real name, which they in turn gave to the police. And the police were like, yo, this dude's got some fucking issues back home. So I tell the hospital. The hospital comes to me and say, yo, we're going to – and now I'm in a lockdown mental institution. It's called Crazy Kate's – well, it's called St. Catherine's. But the cops called it – we're bringing you to Crazy Kate's. You know, you have nicknames for like – they called it Crazy Kate's. It was Catherine Hamilton's mental facility, something like that. That's where I'm at. And they have me locked down up there in the second story. And then they tell me, you know, the police know, you know – they're just going to try and figure out a way to get, ship you back to Philly because you have a bunch of warrants for your arrest. And that's when I was like, yo, I got to make this decision. Am I going to break out of this mental hospital here in Terre Haute? Or am I going to wait until I get to Philly and have to do the whole Juvie Hall again for the third time? And being a neo-Nazi in the Philly Juvie Hall is nothing nice. You know? So anyway, I made the decision that night, called the skinheads from Springfield, Illinois, said, you guys got to come break me out of this hospital. My room overlooked the parking lot by chance, and they showed up in the middle of the night and were shooting out my second story window. And I timed things going at my window with the people coming in my door and just ran and leaped, man, second story, took the window, no bull.
So we, you gotta give this man an intro because I got so many questions right now.
Okay. So this is so good. So everybody listening, this has been in the making for years. I read a book several years ago. It's called The Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead, and it's by Frank Mink. That's the voice you hear right now. So he's telling you the stories. He's no BS. He is going to go back into time and tell you about his life. We're going to answer a lot of questions. He's going to answer a lot of questions. I've been wanting to talk to this dude for a long time, and you see why now. Anybody who's lived through this and anybody listening, he just hit some of the topics that we always talk about. The mental health crisis in America, juveniles getting in and out of trouble, getting introduced to alcohol and drugs. And you heard him at 16 having to make those decisions. Patrol officers and other people who are EMS, fire, anyone who's listening to these podcasts that are in those fields have dealt with that numerous times, and it breaks our hearts. And we can also tell some stories and have some laughs and joke too. But I just want to say, we finally got Frank on here. I got some other stuff in the back of my pocket that Frank and I are going to talk about later. But the guy's an incredible speaker. But go ahead, Ski, you're itching to say something.
I am. So, I want to touch on the safe house, because there's only two types of people that can get in that safe house. There's you guys, and then when law enforcement shows up, right? Mm-hmm. So the whole rest of the world doesn't understand what it's like to get inside that criminal element, inside these houses like you're describing, guns everywhere, militia members. Paint the picture, man. Like, what does that look like inside? Who's in there, and what does it feel like? Because it's making my hair stand up just thinking about it, man.
Yeah, man. And then you guys, you know, have busted our safe houses from, I remember we had safe houses in Ohio that you guys bought, you know. Yeah. So you guys kicking them doors. So you are the only, and the whole, everything that's in that house is to keep y'all out. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way we have the windows secure, if you're doing it the right way, you know, you make that house look basically abandoned as possible, but with a, you know what I mean? And keep the traffic low. Back then this was no cell phones. We had one house, there was an actual house phone in there, but it better be an emergency to plug that phone back into that wall. Like, you all are listening, man, all the time. And maybe you are, maybe, you know, it's,
yeah.
You know what I mean? So, you know, man, I'll be honest with you, man, it's a lot of boring time. A lot of sitting around time. Mm-hmm. A lot of just, you know, looking out the window, you know, just fuck, dude, that's torture sometimes. Yeah. Especially for a 16-year-old dude, you know what I mean? Who just came from like the Philly scene, which was like hopping. And, you know, we were running, we had running street clubs and everything in Philly. We had it going. We had tattoo shops. These guys are hiding out, you know what I mean? But I get it, you know what I mean? But so anyway, it was tough, man. That was the tough part, you know?
So when you, when you've got warrants, like people that don't live that life and don't understand, when you have warrants, every time you see a police officer, what's the first thing that goes through your head?
You know, man, it's, I talk about this a lot with a lot of, when I'm trying to talk to guys that are incarcerated and shit about this.
Yeah.
The freedom of, you don't even know how much it is on your life when, you know, people are like, yo, I'm going to go someplace, and you got to, and you have to think, like, is there going to be a lot of cops there? Like, you have to start planning your life all the time if you're going to not want to get caught. And it gets draining, you know, and it weighs heavy on a lot of things. And I mean, yeah, any interaction, when you have these warrants, absolutely. And it's,
yeah, there's a term that a lot of people used to use called burning the village. Whenever they, when people are tracking fugitives, they're like, you just focus on their, where they are. Like you just said, from Philly, you had to flee Philly because everybody knows who you are. They know your government name. They know your face. Now you got to go somewhere without a lot of the resources. Luckily for you, or fortunately for you, had these resources.
Right.
Just meaning in the criminal world, like that was fortunate for you. Not everybody has those. So when they go out on their own with warrants, they're hiding in and out of hotels. They run out of money. And like you said, then they just get exhausted. And it's like, after a while, okay, you know, you got me. Now, let me ask you this. When we're talking about neo-Nazis and skinheads, you're no longer like that. So I should have probably prefaced it.
Yes.
So if you can you just kind of talk about how that happened, how you even got caught up in that world?
All right. Yeah. So, So this can go long, but let's keep, you guys keep me on.
We're good, man. I'm telling you, people are going to want to hear this. So,
all right. So look, man, I grew up in a tough neighborhood in Philly, Irish Catholic, you know, but it was bordered by a couple of different neighborhoods. You had Cambodians on one side, Italians on the other. And, you know, and that's who you talked about all the time. That's the others, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. So I grew up with just that neighborhood kind of racism, right? Nothing extreme. You know, you keep the black kids out of our neighborhood. We don't go in their neighborhood. You don't go in the Cambodian neighborhoods. Like, it's just I grew up like that with a single mom. You know, we were sometimes on welfare, you know, we were on food stamps back in the day. And, you know, that's embarrassing, man, for a kid. Mm-hmm. You know, you walk in corner deli in Philly and you pull out food stamps to pay for some of the food, and the hottest girl in the neighborhood just walked in the fucking door. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And you're not balling anymore. You're not a baller, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that type of shit's embarrassing growing up. And I loved and respected my mom when it was just me and her. And then she got remarried, and she had some men off and on. And, you know, like, my mom was a party or two. You know, I would find some straws around once in a while, half-cut straws in the bathroom, you know, my mom and her lifestyle. So, you know, and then she finally finds a guy, and he's just a neighborhood alcoholic, drug addict, bar dude, it's a neighborhood dude and not a good dude. Like, and I was born and raised that I was half Irish, half Italian. That's what I was always told. My real last name when I was born with, was one of the, my old aliases I used to, was Frankie Bertolini, because my, was the name I was really born with, was Bertolini. So, my dad's Italian. So anyway, my stepdad hated me because I was Italian. He would always talk shit. He used to talk about beating the Italian out of me, you know, and just not a good man, and very much into drugs and you know, Xanax and Valium and that type of stuff too. So he eventually gets me kicked out of my mom's house. They move with my dad. My dad lives in a really bad part of Philly, like Southwest West Phily, you know, part where Fresh Prince moved out of. Well, my white ass moved into that same neighborhood. All right, no, I'm not joking.
Okay. Yeah, no, I got you. I'm sorry.
That middle school.
Yeah. Okay.
School. And, yeah. And yo, it was a tough school, and there were some cool kids in there, but of course I played baseball. We won the championship. I was on the baseball team. So I had some black friends in and out of school, but, you know, it was getting in and to from school that was help, I mean, I fist fought all the time, and not many of the times were one-on-one. I'm very athletic. My dad's a brawler. My dad's always been a South Philly. I mean, just a Philly brawler, street brawler, tough guy. I mean, I can handle myself, and, you know, you get in one little scrape, and, you know, every time you fight, you're getting jumped, and it was just hell, and I hated it. So now my stepdad's beating me at home. My real dad doesn't pay any freaking mind to me. My dad wakes up, goes to his bar that he sells drugs out of, and does his deal and lives his life with him and his boys in his bar. And then when it closes up, maybe at 4 a.m, he comes home and he does his deal until it's time to get up to go back to the bar. Right.
Mm. Yeah.
So whatever, I can come home with a black eye, man. They just ain't got time. Mm. So, I start cutting school. I start not going to school anymore. Just, I was like, you know what, F it. And a funny thing is, I used to take the trolley the other way into Center City. Instead of going in the deeper in the Southwest, I would go to Center City. I would go like to Ben Franklin's house and sneak in all the museums. And just, that's what I just did all the time. Like, I loved like Ben Franklin, all that good shit. Who, by the way, Ben Franklin created the first police, one of the first police forces. So whenever I hear people talk about how all police forces were made, Ben Franklin made a really good police force that was to stop prostitution and robberies, because Philly's always been Philly. And you know what I mean? First police force ever was by Ben Franklin. Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
That's what's up. So, so I learned that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, my guys, that summer, my dad, I graduated school somehow. I missed the last 40 days of school. Great Philadelphia, great public school districts. I mean, I missed the last 40 days of school, and they still graduated me because whatever. And right. So I got to get out of my dad's house for the summer. My uncle on my mom's side had a house up in the Lancaster area. It's like Amish people, but they're not Amish. They're normal. They're my peeps. And and they moved up there, and they were like, hey, do you want to come hang out with your cousin, who's a couple years older than me, who I was always looked up to. He's kind of a skateboarder kid, kind of a real funny kid. And I love that. He's one of my older cousins. I was born in a group of male cousins. I was the youngest, and then a girl was born after me. But there's about a 7-year span where like 8 or 9 boys were all born, and we were all pretty much crazy troublemakers in a way. So I'm the baby of that group. So anyway, I go up to go visit this one who's a middle cousin. And when I get up there, I couldn't wait to be the year before he was real into punk rock and stuff. So I couldn't wait to go up and hang out with him and, you know, Misfits and Cro-Mags and, you know, Dead Kennedys. I couldn't wait, the skateboard and stuff. And I go up there, man, he's not into that stuff anymore. He was into like Screwdriver and No Remorse. And, he had a big swastika flag hanging in his room. And he had like a Confederate flag hanging in his room. And he had things about Hitler hanging on his wall. And, you know, and I just walked in and was just like, oh, okay, I get it. You know, like, the rebel thing I get, you know, right? I mean, that's all I'm thinking, kind of like, okay. But then, you know, all these other neo-Nazis would come over, and they're all kind of farm boys. And again, not Amish. These are not Amish Nazis. I don't want to start any rumors. Not Amish Nazis.
Right.
They're the pacifists. Yeah. All right. But these were kids that lived in that area. They would come over, and, you know, they would talk a lot of, you know, just all black, you know, just, you know, black people are this way, whatever, and whatever. Yeah. Usually would say the N-word, right? And just,
right, yeah.
I'm talking just kid stuff here. And and as they would say stuff like that, my cousin and I too would include, like, my cousin would be like, yo, you know, like, he takes the trolley every day with black, he takes the L train every day, like this, like, and they're like you see black people every day, you know, I see black people every day. You know, and now people might think I'm making fun of them, because if I would sit them down and say, so you see Amish people every day, because they see people every day. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And anyhow, when these guys would all start to hang out and they would start talking about race and multicultural society will never work. You know, I'm just turning 14. I don't know anything. You say, I have no idea what you're saying. But when they start talking about blacks and whites not getting along, I'm like, I got you. You know, let me tell you something, you know, and they would listen, and people, I felt listening to me, and I was honored. And, you know, just, and also when we hang out with these guys, and then, so now they're backing up this belief, like, yeah, it's all the black people's fault. It's all their fault.
Yeah.
It's all, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so when we go to nightclubs though, and I seen how people were scared of them, I just spent the last 14 years of my life being scared of everything. Scared of my school, scared of my parents, scared of my step parent, scared if I was gonna have enough food to eat. Mm-hmm. And now people are scared of me, like, all right, bet. Mm-hmm. And so And everyone has that in them. You know what I mean? Everyone has a little bit of that. If no, you know, I just have to be to the extreme at the time. So them guys, when we sit around and talk real quick, I'll try to end this part of it. But, you know, it was little things like when people would say things in my neighborhood that when I was growing up, when people were like, you know, oh, Johnny tried to Jew me today. Right. And when I was a kid, I never got the joke. And I remember everyone would laugh. Right. And so I remember when I asked my uncle, I was like, what's that mean? You know what I mean? Like, why does everyone laugh when you say, or when you, how do you start a Jewish parade? You roll a penny down the street. That was a big joke in our neighborhood. My uncle would always say, well, he did say one time, he goes, you know, Frank, you'll get that joke when you're older. It's a funny joke. You'll get it when you're older. Jews are good with money. You'll get the joke when you're older. When I was at some of my first neo-Nazi rallies and they were sitting there talking about, and these are like little just Bible studies and get together. There's a lot of Bible studies in this, by the way. They would talk about, you know, how the Jews are secretly siphoning money off the Federal Reserve to give it to Israel to start the next world war. And they call it the Zionist occupational government, this you know, this cabal, as we're saying, you know. And I remember like that type of stuff, like unlocking the joke. Like, now I get what my uncle was saying. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So when I started to learn this stuff, I started to learn this with the adults knew. And I want to know what you all know, because you left me to fend for myself.
Mm-hmm. And not to mention those little jokes that a lot of people go, they're just jokes. But when you're a kid, and like you said, now it's like you're being introduced into this world and going, oh, I get this joke now. Now this joke makes sense to me. And now I'm surrounded by people that everybody's scared of. And now I have protection. Now I have a family. This gets replaced with this neo-Nazi family. Go ahead.
The crazy thing is, man, is you're describing a kid that would rather go to the museum and learn about Ben Franklin and history, you know, and like there's nobody there to say, come on, kid, let's go do this. And instead you're thrown to the wolves, man. And you got to make a choice, just like your first story. Yeah, like do I keep getting my ass kicked at the museum by myself and nobody standing up for me, or do I go hang with the big dogs? Right, it's crazy though, because it shows the innocence, man.
And I did it, you know. A lot of times when people ask why'd you get so deep in it, was survival. Like it was to me. Like, and I don't know that at the time, but now I know when I look back on my life now why I grasped on. Like, this was a survival tool for me.
Yeah, that's how, I mean, and a lot of people, when I talk about this too, it's, you can take any type of social group like that, be it Bloods, Crips, Sereños, Latin Kings, Gangster Disciples, Sharp Skins, Neo-Nazi Skins, like it, you can pick any of these groups. And I'm not saying, I'm just saying youth-based groups like that, people are looking for protection, whatever it is, you know. If I'm a kid going to a show in the late 1980s and I see two factions of skinheads show up, and it's like you said, it could be Cro-Mags playing or something, and all of a sudden, if you don't know that subculture, you don't know that it's getting ready to be a freaking brawl when that music starts. And the dudes with the swastikas and the Confederate flags are going to be fighting with the dudes over here with like gold laces, you know, and like Trojan record patches and stuff. And then boom, they're going to collide. Yeah. Now, if you're a kid that's unaffiliated, and my buddies have talked about this, I've got a buddy out on the West Coast, and he was a little bit older than me, and man, he would get it a lot because he had a mohawk, cut his hair off, and they would be like, dudes would check him, basically like, what are you? You sharp? You know, are you a brother? And he's like, I'm just a regular guy. I don't have any hair right now. And then the beatdown starts, man. Like, if he says it to the wrong guys, they think, like, if it's some sharp dudes, they're like, oh, he must be a Nazi. They beat him down. If he says it to the Nazis, they think he's a sharp. It beat him down. That whirlwind that was going on in the late 80s and early 90s, you were right in the middle of it, correct?
Yeah. I mean, that's, like I said, I went to prison for kidnapping one of them. I mean, that's, you know.
Tell us about that.
You know, and I would, you know, you guys are law enforcement. So this is to tell you that I know more about what Antifa really does. And I think some of you guys might too, than what is always portrayed, right? Like, they were a huge thorn in our side everywhere we go. Mm-hmm. They just are. And that's, I mean, I know it's freedom of speech and that, but Antifa on that realm is more of a reactionary group. They come out when these people come out, right?
Okay,
And so they've always been this big thorn in the side everywhere we've gone. And they've also taken a lot of the wrath that we want to put out on the world. We have to usually go through them first, right? So we'll do, I know people that have, if they planned on doing any big rallies or any big pamphlet give outs or even setting a, you know, a bomb somewhere at a synagogue or it's, you know, little shit like that, they know to do that, they have to go after Antifa first.
Okay.
Like they will set a thing to go after them first because they need to kind of, because they know they're going to be on them. Because they always find a lot of the time, a lot of those little crimes and stuff that you find, like the spray painting of synagogues by these newer groups and stuff, a lot of that time, those tips that these are getting are from that movement.
From, you know, gotcha. I mean? So, yeah. Because it's the counter to it, right? It's so you're saying, like, yeah.
It's a reactionary group. It's a reactionary movement. When they see fascism or racism rising up, then they go out and they organize. I mean, that's why, and I know that the intelligence on it, because it doesn't take much, you know, it's not a formed group like people think, like this huge formed group. It's just not. Mm-hmm. It's people of this same mindset of being against fascism and racism, you know?
Yeah.
And they just kind of react whenever shit goes down. It's not, you never hear of Antifa, you never hear of, I was extorted by Antifa, or Antifa owns this turf of ground. You never hear that type of language from that, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not that type of group, so.
Okay.
Because let me ask you this, just for clarity.
Sure. Yeah.
Is Antifa formed by is it a bunch of different groups and subcultures that come together for that one purpose? It's almost like an all-star team of different subcultures, or is it like their own, like, you're like, I'm Antifa. You know what I mean? Like, you were hey, this is the crew I run with. This is what I represent. These are my tats. But could you get what I'm trying to ask?
Yeah. No, you're like, I've never seen a real person that truly is in the realm of anti-fascism go around and say, like, I'm Antifa. But I've heard people that say, hey, I'm part of Southside, you know, anti-fascist network type group. So it's like a little group of people, you know, but it's never like Antifa. It's not, you know what I mean? It's always like little subsets that come together that, you know, react when. But I mean, you know, because I know that there's never been any big bust of, you know, Antifa safe houses. You know, like they just run around, you know, and it's a lot younger too. So
yeah, but traditionally they wouldn't be, and that, when I mentioned Sharp earlier involving youth movements and stuff, I wasn't saying Sharp was a gang that was committing like crimes or any of that. I was talking about subculture. So
yeah,
if some kid now is like, yeah, if some kid now is like getting into the movement of Antifa, it's not structured though, is what you're saying. It's not going to be structured like Hammerskins, which are like neo-Nazi chapters,
right? You don't have to join. No one gives you a membership. You're not
right. There's no rite of passage.
Yeah,
to join.
Yeah. You just do anti-fascist work, and you're part of Antifa.
Yeah.
If you do any work or any activism that is anti-fascist, then you're Antifa. That's the best way to put it.
And we're always, you know, I say we, law enforcement, cops are caught in the middle. Because we have to protect the First Amendment. You know what I mean? And we're stuck and we're watching in some cities, people are watching two groups of people just collide and know that it can either be fist fights or it can escalate. Like you said, we could get back into that era, sadly, of bombings and strategic assassinations. If you begin to have someone grow in some type of movement and they're a figurehead, someone could potentially kill them. That's where it gets absolutely crazy, and it's hard for units like intel units to stay ahead of that and to try to be like, okay, we still have to protect the First Amendment, but also if we know two groups are going to come together and there's going to be violence, it's very, very hard to walk that fine line.
Right. And you know, other than when it comes to, you know, yeah, organizing for protests and stuff, but, you know, again, and I know that there's people that are very active in the anti-fascist movement who are like, abolish all police, right? So are people that are, but there's a lot of other people like, no, like that's insane. Like,
right?
That's an insane thought process that we should have no police. So there's a lot of people on there, just like the whole defunding. Like, I know so many of us are like, let's fund them homicide divisions, fund them rape mm-hmm. divisions, fund them special. Yeah. Go get those bad guys. Go get them. You know what I mean? Yeah. Fund the shit out of you guys. Like, you know, and that's so I know a lot of people are on all those groups that there's some level headed people coming out of that do say these things too.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's the same thing. Like I would imagine you can't judge everyone based on the broad stroke. Like if I only meet one person and they are like, hey, I'm part of this Antifa movement, but I also hate police and I want to abolish them. I can't judge you and everybody else based on that and be like, well, I don't know that everybody wants to just completely get rid of police. You know what I mean? Because you're right. That doesn't make sense. Because we have seen that when some cities cut back and they really push policies that allow or not even allow, that actually cause police officers to do less proactive investigations or less patrols, then you see violence go up because there's an absence of police. It doesn't mean they have to write a ticket every time they see somebody jaywalk or litter or something. It just means you just got to sometimes have a police presence to keep some of the violence down. I mean, that's the big thing.
Yeah. And you know,
crazy. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say with the way that technology is coming soon, I mean, there's police officers are going to have like a drone that's just going to come off your car when it's going to follow you. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. we're coming to that age and mm-hmm. we need to embrace, and that's going to be for safety reasons. And we're going to want that type of surveillance on those type of things. I know people always get so scared when we say surveillance, but mm-hmm. we're going to have to keep us safe. And I think a lot of that's going to be, because we have to always keep our servants safe. You're our servants. I mean, absolutely. Our job is to keep our servants safe.
Well, back to what BC was saying about painting everybody with a broad stroke, right? Like, just like listening to your story, right? You're one person, one individual, right? And there's a crazy path that gets you to where you are. So everybody's there kind of on a different road. And then you meet up for the common goal of, maybe it's more so the camaraderie of being part of that group than it is actually what they're standing for.
Absolutely.
Right. You know what I mean? Like a lot of these people out there and they can, you know, people can spew like the common terms and like what we stand for and all the chants and this and that. But then when you really strip it back, like, hey, do you really believe in this stuff? It's like, no, these are just my people. You know what I mean? Like when you get the one-on-one conversations and, you know, there's some true believers out there for sure. But there's a lot of people there that if they had an out, they would go.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that protesting and stuff, you know, I would hope that it's showing solidarity. I mean, you guys got to mm-hmm. remember, I mean, look, you know, 2020 happened. Guys, I mean, the whole world came out and was protesting all over the world. People were like, yo, like even people in Africa were like, yo, they're mistreating Black people a little bit over mm-hmm. there. Even African people. I mean, the whole world came out and was like, hey, there's something not right. Right. And so that's a good thing. And yeah, there were places that were burned and that ruined a lot of the message, just like, you know, other events that have happened.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's big for us when I want to say this, guys, is that I don't look at it as this guy being killed. I look at it as my civil servant publicly executed someone for 9.5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my view of it. And I don't know if officers have that view of it, but that's what really affected me.
Yeah.
For 9.5 minutes, I watched another American being publicly executed.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a big drive for a lot of the people that came out, I think.
Yeah. I think that if you were to take a poll with officers and ask them their opinions on that case and a lot of other cases, given whatever we were seeing and the footage we were seeing, people would agree with you. That's what I'm saying. It's like, it's almost like people are shocked when they say, well, why would an officer support that? We don't support every officer's actions. Now, we actually check our own. And I would even venture to say, if you studied the history of like each department's internal affairs, like Ski and I work together on assignments, and in the department we're in, we're known as eating our young. In other words, our internal affairs come in and will actually investigate officers. And if it ever even got close to corruption, they're gone.
Yeah.
Like we didn't experience that. And I'm very, very fortunate that I did not see what I grew up listening to in the punk rock scene and hearing bands talk about this. And I mean, yeah, we got harassed and we got pushed up against the wall. I've been searched and all that. I'm talking about like massive corruption or like getting my teeth knocked out and stuff, or like black flag shows getting shut down back in the day. You know, like I didn't experience that as a police officer when I was on patrol. I'm fortunate. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen in other cities. Yeah. So when it does happen, we're usually twice as mad because it's like, now we're going to be judged on all our hard work goes away. And now all of a sudden we have an entire country that is judging everyone in a uniform based on one person's actions and the death of a citizen that I can't control. I can't do anything about it. What I can do is in my department is help train my officers and my detectives on some of my gang strategies, on some of my interview techniques or whatever, and just set a good example of, hey, treat everyone with respect. But when it goes to a level of use of force, use the minimum amount of force necessary. We're not out here putting knees and necks and assaulting people and just taking that heavy hand approach that when, you know, in the maybe the 80s and 90s, that was still kind of one of those things that people did. So yeah. I'm just saying that it, but officers don't get to say, we don't get to speak out. We don't get to say a whole lot because we're also judged by our actions from within our department. So whenever we do speak on these issues, we have to be very, very careful.
And it
sucks because I always thought like I'm in the era, the greatest era of police work, because I saw the greatest change in neighborhoods. I saw violence decrease. We've actually had guys get out of gangs and get jobs and become like really, really squared away guys and be good to their kids that they have, because I like to think that our department in our area had really good officers that cared about people. But then when things like that happen and everybody begins to almost like they're hating one another and fighting in the streets, and it broke my heart, man. All the riots broke my heart. There were times when departments, when officers would take a knee with citizens, mm-hmm. and I heard people speaking out and saying that's wrong. And I'm like, nuts.
Yeah.
They're just officers are trying to show that, hey, we are not an occupying force and we are not an extension of some type of corrupt, oppressive government. We are protecting the citizens. And right now we're trying to show you if everyone's peaceful, we're here to protect the peace. I don't know. It was tough, man.
I want to bridge the gap
in the conversation. So that, Frank, maybe. Explain how you left your old life, because obviously now you're still very active for human rights and everything, and it's on a completely different spectrum now. And I don't want to breeze over that. I want people to hear kind of like how you exited and kind of what you're standing for now.
It's amazing. Thank you. Yeah. And first I got to give all credit to God. Okay. So I'm a tough guy, but I didn't have the strength to really pull myself through this. He pulled me through. So I just, all right. So just want to put that first and foremost, all credit goes there. So look, you know, when a Jewish man gives me a job, I get out of, you know, I have a swastika on my neck. Jewish man gives me a job. I had already gone through the prison system, kind of seen some things in there, and also met some other young guys that were my age that I really gelled with. And God just kept putting people in my life to prove me wrong. Like, he just did. And so finally, man, I have this last, like, I want to still stay part of this neo-Nazi realm because this gave me my life. Like, this was, mm-hmm. like, you got, it was my life, man. I mean, I would have given everything for that movement for whatever reason. And I'm seeing it crumble before my eyes. And I'm seeing, like, when new recruits would come in and they would say the same old stupid shit I used to say when I was their age that I thought sounds brilliant. And I would hear them say it now. And I'm like, that's so stupid.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm growing up. So finally, the Jewish man gives me this job. And when he gives me this job, he just was very kind to me. And even though I had a big swastika on my neck. And he was a guy who would tell me I was smart. He would go, I would say I was stupid. And he'd grip me up and go, stop saying you're stupid, you fucking idiot. And he'd go on to tell me about how smart I was. And how he's like, Frank, you figure things out that other people, like, you just was very complimentary to me. And was like, I hate when you say you're stupid. So I just remember having this moment with him too. Now, like, I'd already really been backing off a lot of my views on things, but I was just still part of the neo-Nazi world just for the shit of it. It was all I knew.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this was the final thing where I was just like, you know, I'm done. Like, I got to stop saying I'm okay with this. Like, I know it's wrong. Like, I was consistently banging my head against the wall in the end to believe that because of the color of my skin, I'm better than another human being. Just became the most asinine thought process to me, mm-hmm. and at all. Like, and to know that, like, souls don't have color. Like, souls mm-hmm. don't have color. So there it is. Done deal for me. We were all the same color in his eyes. We're souls. So mm-hmm. boom. All right. And then guys, I'll tell you, man, for years though, I struggled with addiction because I still had, and this is where I want to, I still had like ego issues. I still had low self-esteem issues from the upbringing I had from whatever mm-hmm. shit I was not addressing. And it comes out of me in different ways, man. I'm a type of person, and some people I know will listen to this will feel these feelings because it's drug addiction and alcohol addiction is very prevalent. And that whole ism, that mm-hmm. whole I self-medicate on either too much internet or too much porn or whatever, mm-hmm. You know, and mine's was, you know, the constant thought of myself. Mm-hmm. Always thinking about, oh, I wonder if these people say this about me. And I wonder if this person, you know, I lived this crazy dramatic life. So that ego was really big and I couldn't shut it off sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so what I got to do today is I got to humble myself. And I've done a lot. I've done interventions on neo-Nazis. I've been I've been out of that movement for 30 years. And just so you guys know, for the last 25 years, I worked with so many police departments. You guys brought me in for, like, they would have my book studies, or they brought me in mm-hmm. on hate crime stuff. I mean, I came and helped on some real shit. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. just you guys call me from Albuquerque, you name it, Bear, mm-hmm. Montana. Just people, yo, we need your help. Okay. I'm not no snitch, but I'm here to keep my community safe.
Yeah. Right?
So I would go and be like, hey, here's what I know about that group, blah, blah, blah. I want all types of awards. Working mm-hmm. with the police, FBI, Homeland Security, still battled in and out 3-4 years with my addiction. I would get mm-hmm. clean and sober and do great things and burn it all down again. And mm-hmm. so just being honest. And then I'll just tell you the story, guys, and just take it for what it's worth. This is what happened to me. About 4.5 years ago, guys, I was going through a divorce, which is, if anyone knows, they're brutal. And mm-hmm. it was the end of this thing. And guys, it was... I got arrested. Oh my God. I got arrested because I broke a no contact order because I refereed a hockey tournament to see my kid, you know, just playing, mm-hmm. I was playing the game, being an asshole. You know, I shouldn't have did it, you know, but I was a little good at job and I got in trouble and got arrested. Oh, embarrassing. So embarrassing, mm-hmm. guys. Anyway, this guys, in a 5-year period, I lost my son in a car accident, my mom to fentanyl, my, best man at my wedding, who was like my brother, who's one of those groups of cousins, kills mm-hmm. himself. His brother then kills himself. You know, the divorce, the affairs, everything, mm-hmm. guys. And I was just broken again. And I relapsed. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting in a car in Des Moines, Iowa, gentlemen. And you guys take the story for what it's worth, man. I was sitting in the store in this parking lot of a church. I was just done. Like, I was at the point I said, I'm ready to kill myself. And so I was, but I was like, I don't want to do it. I was like, I knew if I killed myself, it was going to go back on my children. I knew it. And I was sitting in this car and I was dating this girl during my divorce. Don't ask me how I tricked some girl into dating me, but I did. I had some girl dating me during my divorce and I'm at the lowest point in my life. And anyway, I'm sitting in this car. I don't know where to go. I want to go use again. You know, the whole thing. I'm sitting there and I'm just like, God, figure out, please let a Mack truck hit me. Let me hit a telephone pole. Like, I don't want to kill myself, but let it just happened. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And why I'm screaming up to God, guys, that girl calls me and I picked up the phone. Like, this girl just calls me, you know, I'm in the middle of screaming up to God and I pick up the phone and it's her and she's screaming, crying, going, come back to my house. My sister just killed herself.
Oh, man.
Right in the, and so why that happened, guys, just for whatever you want to take, mm-hmm. the whole world just stopped for 1 second for me. And this voice said, go to California. I have work for you. Mm-hmm. Guys, go to California, man. Go find this guy who is my sponsor. You know, he's mm-hmm. my rabbi and my sponsor. Mm-hmm. And there was this guy who had always stayed in my mind over the years. And when that voice said, go to California, go see this guy. I have work for you. I went, and that guy's still my rabbi to this day and my sponsor.
Dude, I got chills, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that guy has walked me. People know what this means. He walked me a dozen steps closer to God. And my job is to help others walk that dozen mm-hmm. steps closer to the job, closer mm-hmm. to God. But in that time, man, God has giving me a reason. So when Oklahoma City bombing happened, I had just gotten out of the neo-Nazis. I was fucking insane. Literally insane, guys. I was a homicidal, suicidal fucking maniac. When Oklahoma City bombing happened and I'm getting out of that neo-Nazi world, that picture of that dead little girl in that fireman's arms is my driving force. That was the force what made me go to the FBI. Like, that picture, that image was burned in my brain. And I went to the FBI and I had this burning, like, I wanted to be so against that. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I sat in rooms with people like Timothy McVeigh. I wanted to be a Timothy McVeigh, no doubt. Mm-hmm. No doubt. Mm-hmm. So there was this fire, and that fire lit me and got me going for a long time, but it went out. And I'm sorry, but guys, when Breonna Taylor got killed during the pandemic, God lit that fire back in me and said, there's something wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
There's something wrong. And I want you to go be a part of helping. And so that's my journey. But that's what I do today. And guys, I played on an all-cop hockey team in Des Moines, Iowa. I coached about probably 15 to 20 cops' kids as a major hockey coach. I mean, there's tons of cops who have kids that play hockey. Love the police. Love the police. So a guy gave me this job for this reason, to, you know, that there's some things that need to be changed. This
And conversations like we're having have to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like we can't not have these conversations, right? Yeah. And like who would ever say, like, from the 30,000 foot, oh, we got two cops talking to a former neo-Nazi. This should be interesting. No, dude. And the way God's using you right now is just, it's not on accident.
Well, and then
there's no coincidences.
Yeah. Then crazy. add the layer like that where you feel like you almost have to apologize to us for how you feel about Breonna Taylor. You shouldn't have to do that. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, that's how you feel. That's your movement. That's your power. Do it, man. Like, I support anyone who's doing something in their heart, and especially if they can go from the life you had to the life you have now and do things that feel good to you, and to have the courage to come on the show and actually talk with us, because that was a big hurdle, I know, for you. You kind of mentioned earlier, like, hey, when we talked about how you ended up in prison, you know, was some things that you did that to other people, they would be like, oh, mark him out, man. He's no good for society. And I've heard people say that before, and there's very few categories of people that can't be rehabilitated or can't have a better life than what they have.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Who's anyone to play God? God can change anybody.
Yeah.
Anybody.
I was just going to say, man, the blood of the cross has made people perfect for those who believe, man. So there's not anything that can't be.
Yep.
Made perfect.
It's all about redemption. It's all about, 100%, you know, man. Me and me being the light of God in any conversation, situation, or relationship. Let me always be the light of God. And how do I do that? By humbling myself to Him.
Mm-hmm.
Humbling myself to Him, and He'll do that for me.
Do you think that when you were 14, 15, somewhere around there, that if someone sort of like the Jewish gentleman that had hired you and told you were smart and that sort of thing, if someone at 14 or 15 would have pulled you aside and told you, like, just a guy, whatever, in the neighborhood, pulled you aside and told you, hey, you're smart. Hey, you could be somebody. And either just them doing that or them taking you in for like a part-time job or something like that, do you think it would have changed your path? Or do you think at that time you needed it to be peers, to be like your cousins and teenagers?
Man, so anyone that's listening, you never go wrong with being kind. So anyone being kind to me could have helped.
Yeah.
Anyone being kind. So that all of us should take that opportunity to know that anytime you act kind, you could be doing something.
Yeah. And I think crazy, we are. Man? Yeah.
Isn't it crazy how just a smile and a 10-second conversation could literally change the trajectory of somebody's life?
Yep.
There, it's hard for a lot of people who, and I'm glad there are a lot of people who grew up in safe. I say that it's good that there are families that grow up very safe and very, you know, comfortable and that sort of thing. But it's hard for them to understand there are kids in this country who have never had someone tell them you're smart or hey, you are not going to go down this path of hate. You're actually going to have a great, wonderful life. And if you follow some of these steps and I'll help guide you, you can get there. It's where sometimes adults or society gets too busy, or it's too easy to say that kid in the Cro-Mag shirt or that kid with the skateboard or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like in your situation, some people may have said, oh yeah, that kid's going to be a troublemaker because he looks different. He listens to different kind of music or whatever. And then it just adds that cycle. So just like you said, once you fall in and you've got these guys that are getting that fear going, and you see that power in it. I think that, and I don't know, just because I haven't seen it pop back up as bad. I know we still have some hammer skin chapters throughout the U.S. and stuff. But do you think it is as severe now with like neo-Nazi skins versus traditional skins or sharp or whatever? Is it worse now, you think, than back then in your heyday?
Or I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if you want to get a yes. It's
we don't. If you don't feel comfortable.
No, I just don't know. I mean, look, the Proud Boys are neo-Nazis. They just are. Like they're just because they today's some of those groups today are just mm-hmm. our group. Back then, but with lapel pins and lipstick in a way. I mean, they're just, so I don't want to get political because I think that there's a lot we can do when we stay out of the political realm. But I think when I see neo-Nazism and anti-Semitism, I see, the Proud Boys as the brown shirts of Germany. And so I see it getting really, really bad.
Okay. Do you think it's a lot of it is repackaging is what you're saying? So in other words, yeah. Like what you and I grew up with like seeing red laces, seeing blue laces or whatever, and you're like, okay, yeah, this is a hammer skin or this is a neo-Nazi skin. Yeah. This is sharp. You're saying now you're starting to see factions that would align the same ideology just packaged or looking.
Dude, even the outfits are the same. They wear like the Fred Perry little things that we used to wear. I mean, it's mm-hmm. but it's just black and gold now or black and yellow. I mean, it's they mm-hmm. wear. I mean, just a lot of identified. It's, I mean, it's just the same thing. It's just been And it's like every time like the Klan did something bad and then that died out. Then mm-hmm. And then the '60s and the first Nazi movement came up and then they did bad shit and they went away and it got repackaged as this and then it got repacked and it just always goes back down and it's all fear. It's all based in fear. It's fear of what's new, what's coming, and to know that, the truth is that there's not one person on this planet that can stop this from happening is that in 300 years, we're one tribe. Mm-hmm. We're one color. Nobody in this world can stop that from happening because of love, just the way we are, as many people as there already are, the way that God already made us today, which we need to love, because if God made us this way, we are going to merge to be one tribe. Mm-hmm. And so how do we get there?
Yeah.
Right. How do we get there without there being more resentment, more hate between us? Mm-hmm. Do we owe some amends? Do we? I feel we do. I think for us to mend a little bit better. So, but that's the end thing is that we, and in 300 years, we're going to look back, they're going to look back on the people that are racist and go, oh my God. Mm-hmm. We really, the human race really believed that we were better than another person because they call, like, we really believed that back then. Oh my gosh, we were Neanderthals.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Like, when we were all kids growing up, I thought as a grown man, I would look back and be like, that era before that, coming out of the civil rights movement, the Jim Crow South, especially where I grew up,
right.
Like, by the time I'm a grown man, nobody's going to care. There's going to be so much, biracial families. And I mean, look, we have a biracial president, President Obama. That's 8 years straight is a biracial president. And I always say that. And sometimes people will stare at me and I'm like, I think it should be celebrated that we got to an era where most Americans don't really get hung up on race. But who gets the spotlight in the news are people who push it to that, and what I hate too is that fear or controversy drives headlines. So kind of like what we've talked about is kind of like that idea of if we can divide people and get them to fight more, then I can sell more ads on my news channel or whatever. And that's what I hate. I want more people to understand that there doesn't have to be violence or conflict, and especially not based on just pigment. What I mean?
Well, and I hope you take this for what it's worth, coming from a former right-wing radical who knew how to push the buttons. And I look at our media differently, I think, than a lot of other people. Because I used to look at them as they were these left-wingish killers. And then, you know, when you go one way or another way. But I could tell you, to me, it's this way. Maybe you guys will agree. In the end, you might not. But here's the funny thing. CNN will lie to you. Every flu season is going to be the worst flu season that they've ever seen on the record. This year, guys, and that's CNN lies. That's CNN lies. Like, this is the worst flu season ever. You know, even though I said that last year and the year before, right? So that's a CNN lie. MSNBC lie is when there's a pursuit, a cop pursuit, and they wind up getting and hurting or killing a guy. They forget to leave out the part about the felony stop that they had on the guy, right? Because they want more of the look at the victim, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But right, you follow. But Fox News lies to make us hate each other more.
Okay.
Tucker Carlson, I believe, as a former radical, guys, I believe he's very, very dangerous. And if you guys follow the Bible, no one's ever the devil, no one's nothing like that. But there's just tricks when the serpent comes to Eve to eat of the fruit. He never tells her to go eat the fruit. He never says, go eat that piece of fruit. He keeps asking her questions to lead her that way. Well, I'm just asking the questions. But there's never a tone to where I think you should go with it. But I'm always just asking the question. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you guys, I hear the same things I used to say out of his mouth. It just, instead of saying the Jew word or the K word for Jews, it's big media. But it's the same sentence, same texture, same everything except for the word. So so they all have failed us. They all have failed us horribly. I believe that.
Yeah, I checked out about 5 or 6 years ago from any kind of news, like watching any news channels. And somehow I still kind of hear what's going on in the world. And if I need to know something, I'll research it. But
sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. But I really can't take like the whole division that has gone on where we are, like I said, we're being pitted against one another. And it's, you know, coming from the punk rock scene, you question everything. So anytime, you know, when I was a kid, it was like Jello Biafra taught me to question the news, to worry about California politics, which I was a kid, I didn't know any better. But it trained me to just kind of go, okay, the news is on. Is that true? Is a little hyperbole? Like, what are we doing here? So that's why I start to just get really upset, because there are people that will align themselves with Fox, CNN, Starbucks, Black Rifle Coffee. Like, I mean, we see it in products, and Skin, I've talked about it before, and it's like, I don't know that I like this too much.
Design, right? It's a method of control, right? If you get stuck in the web of choosing, they have your control, right? Whoever you choose, then they control you in a sense of going, well, we counter what you don't believe over here, so come with us, right? And in some way, shape, or form, you buy into it, whether it's a little bit or whether it's a full commitment of a swastika tattoo on your neck, right?
Right.
And that's the reality of it, man. Like, if you can be a free thinker, if you can be sovereign, right? Like, dude, the whole Bible is about, you know, the freedom of choice, right?
Yeah.
There's never the force there. So whether you're a Christian or not, still take that fruit from the book of it's all free will.
Well, right? Proverbs is for all three religions, right? Proverbs is for everybody. Proverbs is for Islam, it's for Judaism, I mean, it's King Solomon's proverb. And what's Proverbs tell us to do? All Proverbs is go educate yourself to go be of use in the world. That's all Proverbs. Mm-hmm. If you read, it's a love letter to education from King Solomon. Right? So, and that's for all the Abrahamic religions, which is billions of us, are to educate ourselves to make the world a better place around us. That's what the book tells me, you know?
Right.
The book tells me.
Well, let me ask you this question. You've got both perspectives, right? Because you've been far right, and now you're in the activist scene. What is your perception of law enforcement in 2023? And don't hold back, man. Like, you're not going to hurt feelings.
I'm not. All right, gentlemen.
Yeah.
So when we look back now on, and I'm going to explain this to you guys, but when we look back now on when we see cops with dogs biting
black guys crossing a bridge or spraying fire hoses. And we look back on it now, or kids trying to go to school. We look back on it now and go, oh my God, I can't believe we did that. Mm-hmm. I believe law enforcement pulling black people out of their cars for not using a blinker mm-hmm. is going to be, and the growth of mass incarceration behind that move, in my opinion, is going to be the thing that we look back on 30 years from now and go, oh my God, I can't believe we our government was allowed to pull people from a car and search them for any little crime just because of whatever probable cause. And So on that being said, I want to say that being the activist that I am in the circles that I run around, I don't bullshit with anyone. I do talk about loving the police and knowing that we're all children of God and these are people's jobs. And, you know, people do jobs to have servitude towards us. And I think that sometimes in law enforcement, the servitude towards us, the people, mm-hmm. gets lost in mm-hmm. wanting promotions, getting certain things, getting a lot of IDs. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to look back on that and see how that's the growth of mass incarceration, because mass incarceration is the growth of the county jail system of America, not upstate. Upstate has slowly, gradually grown, mm-hmm. but the upstate, the county jail system and the privatization, that those numbers now double in people. And that only happened mm-hmm. in the last 25 years. So I think we're going to look at stuff like that.
Yeah,
good.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I'm familiar with what you're talking about. I want to say it was the new Jim. Was it the new Jim Crow? There's a book written several years ago about mass incarceration and that theory. But yeah, I mean, we're with you. I would never support anyone stopping a car on a tag light or anything, and that solely being why they pull someone out. And I'm quite sure that stuff goes on. I also know, though, that what happens with a lot of stuff that I worry that as a society, we haven't slowed down enough to study each case of, like, the YouTube videos. You can literally pull up YouTube videos of officers getting in shootings, but the video will only show like the 10 seconds when the shooting occurs. It may not give you the background that during that traffic stop, that person was reaching under the seat. They were reaching under the seat. The family had told the officers, and I'm not talking about that case. I'm talking about just in general cases that had work and stuff. And the scenarios are always changing. So that's the one thing I worry about with society. I know what you mean. Like, I always look at, I went into a profession that a lot of people told me don't be a cop. I listened to music that told me cops are bad. And so when I joined, I did have an idea that I'm going to right some wrongs. If I run across some good old boys who are what I deem corrupt or racist or anything, I'm a clean house on them. But I never encountered that. What I did encounter were officers that were really professional and really dedicated. You had some jerks here and there. I mean, everybody knows that. Most of those guys or girls wash out. The one thing that I will say I worry about, and I think there's a huge movement in law enforcement that we don't get on the news and brag about or talk about it, is self-awareness and being ego-free. Because like you said, when you start looking at it and going, I want to get a promotion. Well, if my department only will promote me because of drug arrest or whatever, then that's what I'm going to go seek. Now, that could be good for the community if somebody's motivated and they say, now I want to make promotions. However, if I can make a promotion by arresting the most violent guy in your neighborhood now gets safe. That's a win-win. It's not a win when somebody's eat up with that ego and they go out there looking for something and they escalate the situation. That's what, like, Ski and I, anytime we talk about these cases, we look at, did the officer do anything to escalate it? And was
that's funny.
Were they in control of their emotions, and were they doing things within the law? Or were, like you said, or are they looking to create a problem or push someone enough to be angry enough to where they do something to get arrested because they can't control their own anger? Because maybe the guy said something about their race or their face or what, I mean, whatever it is. But I'm sorry, Ski, you were going
to
say something.
Yeah, I'm just looking at it from a different perspective and trying to remove myself from it. I was a very, very aggressive police officer, not like a heavy-handed officer or anything like that, but I just loved police work, right? So mm-hmm. I would bury my face in the arrest, search, and seizure book, and I would bury my face in the criminal elements book, right? So I would literally, like, where a lot of officers that are, I guess maybe we'll just say ignorant and not as knowledgeable would say, mm-hmm. oh, you know, Ski, you walk in the gray. And I'm like, no, I just know exactly what I can do and up mm-hmm. to what point I can do it, right? So I think about, like, what you're saying about pulling people out of the car and stuff, and just kind of like looking back at things that I've done, and I'm like, well, just from myself, I've always done it within the guidelines of that book. Now, that doesn't mean, like what you're saying, Frank, that those guidelines don't need to change, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. right? And there's the difference, right? So, like, you have an officer, maybe that we'll just use myself as the example of you're watching me and you're going, what's wrong with this guy? Why is he doing that to everybody, right? And all I'm doing is going, look what a good job I'm doing, guys, because I'm following all the rules. Absolutely. And then my argument to Frank would be like, well, Frank, I can do that, man. So whether you like it or not, the law says I can do it. So it's like this big cycle of, like, you know, it comes back on law enforcement, but, like, I always tell people, like, I don't write the laws. I enforce the laws. So there's a difference, right? And so it's very interesting perspective, man. And like you said, there are some laws that, like, you look back on and you're like, man, this is stupid. Yeah. Like, this doesn't make sense, right?
And so, and it goes, you know, way above all of our pay grade. And that's the whole legalize of marijuana, right? I mean, the reason and the only reason why that thing gets stuck and will never happen for the next maybe 5, 6 years, maybe 10 years. And it is the truth is that the police lobbyist unions and associations are like, don't do it because it's the easiest thing to search a car over.
Yeah, it's I mean, honestly,
that really is. It's, like,
that would be the only reason.
Search your cars.
Yeah, a proactive police officer is going to go, man, now I got to work harder for probable cause to search the car.
But I will counter with that because I'm with you. I've got my own personal opinions about things. But we could also search a car if a container of alcohol is open.
Yeah.
And so we do have legal. Yeah. So I think I'm with you though. I do think that if marijuana is legalized or decriminalized across the board, mm-hmm. you know, it's federalized or whatever the term is, where the federal government will say, go grow what you want, go sell mm-hmm. what you want, whatever. We're just going to tax the hell out of you. If they do that, I think then still with the vehicles, you still wouldn't want or still wouldn't be able to consume or smoke weed in a car. But I'm with you. This is the thing that is tough because the way I am, I want to be left alone. I don't want to be stopped every time I leave my neighborhood because mm-hmm. my tag light's out or whatever, like these little...
Because of your skin color.
Well, see, so this is a perfect topic. So so the neighborhoods that Ski and I worked were predominantly Black, probably 99% Black, right? A lot of gang activity, a lot of drug sales. And what I saw shift maybe 5 to 6 years ago, I would hear citizens saying, I don't want my kid to get killed in a traffic stop. And I'll be like, well, why would I stop your kid? One, and then two, why would I kill them? And so I had a woman who was a math teacher, and her son was getting ready to go to college. He wanted to be an English major. So we were talking about literature and stuff. But she was so worried. I said, ma'am, have your son sit in your car. We were talking at a cookout, like an event. I was on duty. I was like, have him sit in the car and I'll do a traffic stop with him. And I'll show you exactly what every traffic stop is. And he did everything right and followed, you know, when I asked him something, he answered whatever. I said, that's every traffic stop. It goes just like that. It goes sideways if people reach, if they do stuff, if they tell the officers, F off, you can't stop me. Why are you doing this? Which we've had, you know, traffic stops escalate and we can't ever figure out why. We're like, don't do that. That's how it escalates. The traffic stops, what she was saying was, well, he's a young Black man and you're going to stop him because he's Black. Like, and she wasn't like being confrontational.
Right.
But she said it like it was a fact. And I was like, ma'am, well, first of all, the whole district pretty much is Black. So everybody's almost the same race, homogenous. So mm-hmm. whoever we stop are either going to be Black, male, female, trans. Like it doesn't matter. If you're going off a pigment, I will say this. When you're driving or riding in a car, look at the car in front of you, because most traffic stops we do are cars that are in front of us. You know, a lot of times, at least I've never run radar or done any of that crap. Mm-hmm. I could talk all about New Jersey in 1990s and racial profiling with radar guns and stuff, but I wasn't there, but I've only what I've read. But what I can say is ride down the street and look at the cars ahead of you. And you'll see the cars with no seatbelt because you'll see the little reflection of the seatbelt buckle up on the above their left shoulder, you know. Yeah. So you could look and go, there's no seatbelt. I'm gonna stop them for no seatbelt. Or whatever the violations are, ran a stop sign, whatever, didn't put on a turn signal, whatever it is. It's very, very hard to tell the race of the driver in front of you. Okay. Hell, a lot of times you can't tell if it's an adult, teenager, because of the headrest. And at night times, if you're not in like cities with like a lot of street lights and stuff, it's very, very tough. I say that because mm-hmm. when we call in radio stop or traffic stops, we'll call in, you know, for us anyway, we get behind the car, we see it, we run the tag, make sure the tag's not stolen or linked to a homicide or robbery or something. Mm-hmm. Cause we're trying to mitigate all these different factors that could get us right. killed.
How safe. Yeah.
Yeah. So then we call it. Yeah. Call in the radio. Totally yeah. Good. And one of the things that we often do is we will say occupied one time or two times or three times, meaning how many people are in the car. That lets our coworkers know, oh, you're doing a traffic stop, so we're going to send one check in. One person's going to ride over, an officer to check on you. Oh, it's occupied three times. Hey, I got two units, you know, to key up. They get en route. And many times, man, I have been like occupied one time and I walk up and there's three or four people in the car because I can't see because of the headrest.
Okay.
So I will say that because I've always thought like, how can I explain to people that race is almost never a factor, at least for us. And I don't know. It's one of those things that when you stop cars, unless you're a traffic unit, you're not really running radar. You're like moving around the neighborhood. You're trying to be present. You're trying to be known and seen. And then you stop a car and those blue lights are going. Then people are like, all right, they're on the game today. They're stopping cars, you know. And I'm talking about areas that are pretty active. But
yeah, yeah.
I'll add a little humor to this. Frank, if you rolled through my beat at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm stopping you. I'm finding a reason, right? Like, right. Like it's the anomaly, right? So it's absolutely. Funny because you're like, all right, what is this dude doing over here? Because like BC says, like, this is a predominantly black area, predominantly mm-hmm. African-American, whatever race. And then here come you rolling through at 2 o'clock in the morning. And my training and experience would kick in and I'd go, okay, this dude's looking for a prostitute or he's looking to score a rock. You know what I mean? And you can't act off that, right? Like you can think it all day and I can, you know, like go down those rabbit holes of, oh, I'm an officer, my training and experience, blah, blah, give you the spiel, but you still have to find the reasons, right? But it is funny though, like, cause you know, not to counter BC, but to say like, are there people out there that are solely reacting to race? Yeah, absolutely. We can't deny that, right? 100%. BC and I, not happening, right? We're, again, by the book, nose down in the, you know, just working and that's within the.
Yeah, and that's the best part about it. If you put me in a different area or a different city, you know what I mean, like a different district, and we didn't have. Heavy gang areas, heavy drug areas, I would probably get really, really, really bored because that's all I wanted to do. That's what I enjoy doing. But I would have a lot of conversations with citizens about that because when I would stop cars, people would often say that. And I would have guys say that, like, man, you just stopping another black man. And I'm like, I'm sorry, dude, but your race has nothing to do with this. Mm-hmm. It has everything to do with the traffic stop.
Right.
So it is tough. I mean, understand that is the perception because it was my perception when I was a kid that the cops are stopping me because I'm a punk rock kid. Right. You know what I'm saying? And I'll give you one better. I got denied access to my own police stations. Like we have all these satellite stations when I was in a drug unit because of the way I looked twice, they wouldn't let me in the building. I had one guy not even let me in the bathroom. And he was like, negative. I was like, no, hold up, dude. And I had to show him I'm a detective. I'm going to go use the bathroom. So I do understand what you're saying. I would also flip that to say, is that the same thing if a black officer is stopping cars?
Yeah.
Are they stopping it based off of white males or white race?
I mean, anytime that is completely wrong. We all agree on that.
Right.
But, you know, but when there's activists who are saying, you know, there's plenty of towns that do policing for profit, you know, mm-hmm. the whole town's revenue is off of these guys mm-hmm. just getting everybody that comes through. And, you know, they look, and this is for a fact, and they look for, especially if they're in a suburbs of an urban area, man, they wait for urban blacks to cut through. Come on. You know,
that could be true. I'm saying, like, my perspective.
I've been caught in a speed trap and written a citation, man. So I'm all, you know, the areas, right?
Yeah.
You're saying, like, in other words, if someone's working an area that is predominantly Caucasian or something, those officers are looking for violations in order to write a bunch of tickets. The old saying used to be, if the lights come on, somebody's got to pay the power bill. Meaning, if I turn my blue lights on, somebody's getting a ticket.
Right.
Yeah. We're fortunate in the area we work in. It's almost like people are like, stop writing so many tickets, stop arresting people. Like, and then, but in certain areas, if you don't have a presence, at least, I'm not saying you got to arrest everybody or write a lot of tickets. Cause I know what you're talking about. I want to say it was out of, the Ferguson study, where they were learning that there was the suburbs were a lot of their revenue was coming off of citations. So you would have, okay. So here's a perfect example. If a department comes in and says, you know, you're work 12-hour shifts on patrol, we want to document and capture everything you do in those 12 hours because we want to get our money's worth. That potentially can condition an officer to go out there and write every violation they come across.
Yeah.
And if they do that, you're right. It's horrible. I was an aggravated assault detective. And I, at one point, because of some of the policies that some people were enacting, I had victims' mothers mad and wouldn't talk and cooperate because they were holding citations for stuff like unsafe tires, no driver's side mirror, like completely ridiculous traffic charges. I'm saying it ridiculous because it's not my assignment to go out there and keep the highway safe. I'm saying in the city, in the department, in the neighborhood I was in, that type of citation means like 2 weeks worth of work. You just lost all that money because you got to go to court. You got to pay these fines. And guess what? If you had the money for tires, they wouldn't be unsafe.
Right. So they talk about putting people in a hole.
So like I've had a woman sit there and cuss me out because I was part of a department that she looked at and said, the same damn neighborhood, you talking to me about my son getting shot and two other people getting murdered at a shot house. And the officer's going to stop me and write me a ticket for these, as she said, these like weak ass charges.
Right.
What are y'all doing about the neighborhood? And I can't say it because I'm like, she's right. Why not use discretion with her and go on and work that area, that shot house or the gang in the area? But go ahead.
What does a middle ground even look like? Like, where do we meet in the middle, right? And I don't feel like this is an us versus them conversation at all. I love that. This is such a good conversation. Now the whole world hears it. But, like, this conversation has to happen a million times over. And then eventually more people are going to be like, gosh, there's logic on both sides. And Frank's making good points. And BC's making good points. And Ski's making good points. Wait a second. They all agreed on something. Wait, they all disagreed on something. You know what I mean? Like, what does the middle ground even look like, man?
You know, I feel that the middle ground is going to be some real concrete police reform that is going to happen. That in time where it's not even going to tell anymore, but it is, I think a lot of it is, I hope that you guys will start to agree that the Fourth Amendment was given so that we didn't have mass incarceration. I mean, that was why these things were invented. I mean, that's why they've written these things up. And I truly believe that Black people don't have a Fourth Amendment. Maybe with you guys, but with other, they don't have a Fourth Amendment. Like, they get them out of cars, they search the car, like, they don't even ask sometimes. And it's kind of prevalent. And I think that once we come to the conclusion that, like, yo, we're all American citizens, this is Philly, not Fallujah. We need to calm down. You know what I mean? We're not an occupying force against each other. I truly believe that that's going to be some of the stuff that's going to help in the healing. And I also, this is something I would love for the police to do more of. And this is more in school. And this is going to be stuff so that we can keep each other safe. Is like, if we're going to have less car searches in this country, let's have the police go in and say, look, we don't want to pull you out of the cars, but we also want to be safe. So do classes once a year for every school. And it's like, look, keep your hands like this. Let us be. Mm-hmm. And also recruit, because we need more cops. We need more cops. We need more cops, good cops. And so, I mean, we could start doing things, but I think there's such a level of distrust and that's not bad. And I don't like it.
And I think
you hit the nail on the head. It comes down to education, like the education of what law enforcement does, and like kind of like BC's describing the traffic stop, and he actually sat that young man down and walked him through it. But it is the open line of communication without having that superior, like, well, we're law enforcement, we don't have to tell you our tactics and this and that. And which, yeah, there's a lot of truth behind, you know, you can't show all your cards, but let's be honest, at this point in the game, right, the cops know what the criminals do, the criminals know what the cops do. It's a cat and mouse game, right? So it's really just having the conversations. Go ahead, BC.
I was going to say a perfect example. Ski and I were on a street level gang unit, meaning we were doing a lot of just enforcement and interactions. And we rolled deep. We had a pretty large unit. So when we would stop cars, we'd have several check-ins that would reduce the use of force. But I got a guy out of a car one time, and he was getting upset, and he was complaining, and I was explaining to him, the reason I got you out of car is I can smell marijuana. You got shake all over the seat. You know, there were some other things I don't want to get into, but there was a few things going on that he was tied into. It wasn't just a guy who smokes marijuana. It was a guy who was part of an East Coast blood set, who was part of some ongoing shootings, that sort of thing. So all I was doing was just explaining, like, but listen, and he's getting upset, you know. And one of the guys on the unit had kind of not interrupted me yet, but like I was explaining to him, by law, this is what I'm doing, and this is why I can do it. I'm not doing anything corrupt. You're on dash camera, you know, microphone. This is before body cameras. Our car's recording. If you got any problems, you go straight to IA, Internal Affairs. They'll pull the video. They can hear. They can see. Everything's on the up and up. Just follow my commands. Let's get out of the car. Later, one of the officers was like, I don't know why you're doing that. You're telling him everything we can do. He should learn that on his own. That's for him. And I'm like, no, because he believes, or maybe he doesn't, but at that point, I felt like he believed we were not doing something that was legal because he had never been pulled out of a car before. He had never been searched before. So that's what I was trying to explain to him, because I remember being a kid and not understanding why I was being searched outside out of a show. But those types of things, if things are being explained, I think then people can at least understand, okay. And hell, nowadays you pick a phone up and you can Google Fourth Amendment. You can Google whatever you need go, you know what? This traffic stop was completely bogus. Like, this dude was off his rocker. I'm going to IA. I'm going to complain. I'm going to have his job. And with body cameras now, like, it is amazing what's captured. Or conversely, people go, you know what? That officer's respectful. I was wrong. I shouldn't have had the weed in the car, but I was respectful and they cut me a break and they didn't even write me a ticket or whatever it is. I just, like Ski said, like if, and you said as well earlier, Frank, if we can all just start to talk and at least go, okay, we can talk about opinions. We can talk about life. If our ultimate goal is for everybody to get along and be peaceful and to be just a little kind, a little nicer to each other, eventually we'll get there. You know what I mean? Like, that's I think that's the big thing, is like to just at certain angles, like, just push for that. Hey, just, can you slow down, talk to some people, be nicer, smile, open the door for somebody, talk about the music that matters.
I got a business idea for the three of us. If we can come up with something similar to like the coexist sticker, man, like, we'd be millionaires overnight. I'm just throwing that out there. So
it's true. Yeah. But hey,
I want to ask you guys a question.
Yeah,
as officers, how are you guys handling the cop watching thing? How is that? That's
cop, cop watching.
Defrauding, you know, the frauditors, as people call them, as I know, you know, the First Amendment auditing.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah. First Amendment auditors. Yeah. I don't care either way. The only thing I ever worry about is if somebody is coming up, and if what you're talking about is, like, we've had people before, they come up like on the property of a police station, they start to record and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't sweat that. What I do worry about is, like, if let's say me personally or Ski or whatever, like if we were out doing an investigation or a traffic stop where we have someone detained and someone comes up and puts a camera in our face, it's kind of like, whoa, for a second, record what you want. If I say, let's stay back about 10 feet, it's not because I'm worried you're going to catch me doing something wrong. It's because if the fight starts with this guy or girl, whoever I've got, you're now part of it. So you're either going to get hurt as a third party, or you could be part of this. You know, that's the only time I worry. Right. I don't sweat too much of that stuff. I've seen videos before where I want to say there was some state where they had troopers, highway patrol, and some guy was complaining about how they would speed because they would go to like a training facility.
Yeah.
And so he started following them basically and was like in their face, like, why are you speeding? Why are you speeding? And they were really just running late for training. And one of the guys had like a big gulp, like this big silo of like Mountain Dew or something. And it looked bad because here he is as a trooper, you know, that's basically what they do is write speeding tickets. And he's doing like Mach 12 down
the road. Right, right, right.
So it is a way, man. This is the thing that I look at. Citizens, we are citizens. I'm a human being.
Right.
It's checks and balances. Mm-hmm. If we lived in a police state, you wouldn't have someone to have the freedom to be able to do that. Yeah, I like that. I mean, that I think that things like that keep people in check. We're spoiled in our area. We really do have a great department. And that history goes back for decades, and I won't go into it too much because we keep things general and generic where we are, but we're spoiled. I know we are because I have had a buddy go and work in the ATF in a different part of the country. And his main focus was going after corrupt, like drug units and stuff that were just way out of hand in like these rural areas down in the South. Nice. So whenever I speak about this, some people get frustrated. I have to always say it's just my experience. I've been spoiled. I've worked with some of the best cops and FBI agents and ATF that are around. But like you said, like I think that if someone has something to hide or they don't like, they enjoy the power maybe. And so now they may go, well, I don't want you whatever auditing me or cop watching me or whatever. And I'm not quite familiar with all of it, but I don't sweat that. I don't want someone putting my personal information out there and then threatening me at my home because that's just jacked up. Like people, you know, that are filming a police station or filming police officer during a traffic stop, we film ourselves, so I don't have a problem with that. I just don't want someone intervening up like within about 5 feet, 7 feet. Like, okay, I don't know who you are, and my attention is on this car, this driver. You never know why I'm talking to this person. And if you come up, and I'll give a quick story, 10 seconds. I was a patrol sergeant. There's no such thing as a 10-second story with me, but I was a patrol sergeant, rainy night, and a car gets hit, sideswipe, hit and run. So this is my old beat, like where I was a patrol officer, worked gang unit together. Like now I'm back as a sergeant. I'm all motivated. It's the same area. I know it. I know all the cuts. I feel comfortable. I pull up. I'm waiting for the officer to come take the report. And I just get out and start talking to the occupants in the car. It's pouring down rain, and it's four black males in the car. So we're just talking, cutting up. And one of the guys was from the area, right? So we're just talking, you know, this shooting happened, this happened. A van stops. Guy rolls his window down. It was a white male. And he yells, "Stop harassing them." Now I'm in the rain, and I'm just staring at this guy, and they can hear him. Mm-hmm. And the van drives off. And they're like, "Do you get that a lot?" And I was like, "Yeah." And that guy, that white male, assumes you guys are either being harassed by me, assuming you could never be the victim of a hit and run, I guess. And they're like, "Man, that's messed up. He just judged you." I'm like, "Yeah." Now, who wants to be a cop? And they all laugh and look at their buddy in the back seat. And I'm a master of body language. So I'm like, "Man, you want to be a cop?" He's like, "That's all I've ever wanted to be." And they mess with me all the time. He's like, "I want to be a cop." I said, "All right." We exchanged phone numbers. The very next day, that guy said, "How do I fill out the application on the website?" He got hired in another agency, and I went to his graduation less than a year later. Now, how cool is that, dude?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's just those small things like that that I'm like, man, just spread the good. Like, this dude drives by, and he's watched too many TV or too much news and assumes that you guys couldn't be the victim of an actual crime or that I'm just out harassing people in the pouring rain, like. And the guy goes and visits a cop.
I love it, man.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Frank, do you still listen to a lot of music, man? We love music. We always get into that talk.
I am a big music guy. We didn't get to like the end of it, but you know, I converted to Judaism. Well, I actually found out I was Jewish. DNA. Okay. My last name, Mink, is actually a Jewish name. We found that out. I only found that out like 7 years ago. So I converted over. Listen to a lot of religious stuff, a lot of Hebrew stuff, but I'm still a big like Nipsey Hussle fan. Like, so I'm more like in the hip hop side. I'm trying to think of something old punk that I was listening to lately. I'm becoming that old guy now. I listen to a lot of old like
Hey, because you're old, you still have a CD player in your car. So if we got in your car right now, what CD is in the dashboard?
Right now, it'd be Nipsey Hussle right now.
That's all right, man. That's all right. Yeah. Isn't it? And don't worry, man. We're going to bring you back as long as you want to come back. So there's a lot of other stuff we want to talk about. But yeah, as far as music goes, man, we always joke about, talk about, that's the like one thing that a lot of people can link up with, you know what I mean? And be like, oh man, you need to check this out or check that out. So then that's actually interesting. You said hip hop. I was kind of assuming you would like go back to like some old school metal or something like that. That's pretty cool, man.
Yeah. I'm a Meek Mill. I'm a, you know, the, oh, that type
that's
of rap.
Funny.
I'm a Philly guy.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
I thought about my music choice because we do it on every episode. We give suggestions or what are you listening to right now? And mine is kind of ironic because you actually brought up some of the flags that are associated with this band back in the day. But right now I'm stuck on not Skynyrd, Freebird, but specifically the solo. I want to just listen to the Freebird solo over and over again, man. And I want that to be like the theme for my life. Like everything. I'm at the grocery store, man. I want like just to be like throwing groceries in the cart, listening to them. Just somebody just chop it up.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm going with Skynyrd, Freebird solo.
Wow. Okay. There you go.
I will tell you, there's a band called Quaker City Nighthawks. And somehow I stumbled on that. And I want to say it was probably like Spotify recommended or something like some, artificial intelligence is now telling me what music I should listen to, but it's just like a laid back band. I've only heard one or two songs, but I'm starting to kind of get into that.
I wonder if they're from Pennsylvania, Quaker City.
I would assume so. I mean, I need to research a little bit more. If I had the CD or album, I'd be sitting down reading the lyrics, looking at the artwork, you know. And then I dusted off some old Street Dogs. So Street Dogs are actually Friday night. I went out and spent probably about an hour and a half in a bar. This is St. Patrick's Day, hanging out with a really cool person. And they played one too many Dropkick Murphys songs. And I don't mean that disrespectfully. I like Dropkick Murphys. I was wanting to switch it up. You know, I was like, hey, hit me with some Stiff Little Fingers. Hit me with a little something different, some Flogging Molly. Like, I got it. Just give me a little mixture. She had taken me to that place before, and they were playing like a lot of really cool punk. But it got me itching for Street Dogs, and so I broke it out. Street Dogs is actually the former lead singer of Dropkick Murphys. He was the first lead singer. Okay. Had been in the military, grew up in Boston, was a Boston firefighter. Very, very big into like late 70s punk, you know, and that sort of thing. But Street Dogs at one point had a drummer from Mighty Mighty Boss Tones. But man, Street Dogs, you might dig it. It's at one point they got a little slower, a little more like folk, very opinionated, very open-minded, man. But if also you want to get a pit going, you could throw in some Street Dogs and switch it up. But
that's a long way from Nipsey Hussle, man.
I know.
Hey, have you guys ever listened to a band called Hippie Sabotage? You ever heard of them?
No.
Pretty good. Hippie Sabotage. They're really, really good.
If you get Let me write it down. Is that out of Philadelphia?
Writing it down, man.
No, I don't know where they're out of, but they kill me. I get to do, I do a God walk every morning, and I have like a set of songs, you know, and they're one of the sets of my song. And they have some good shit, man.
I'll have to check them out. I think you've got Wisdom in Chains up in Philadelphia, man. It's a hardcore band that I blast that sometimes. But, dude, if I listen to hip-hop, it's all old hip-hop, like from the late 80s, early 90s, like Public Enemy, Boogie Down Production, KRS-One, stuff like that. So,
like a Biggie? Lot of,
yeah. Tupac. I mean, even like – it was funny, like when Tupac started getting more positive, man, that's when – Some other people stepped in like, oh, we need some yeah.
Every time there's an enlightened one. I'm telling you, Nipsey Hussle was enlightened. Yeah. He started saying, like, let's stop fucking killing each other and let's start building buying businesses. I mean, that's what he was rapping about at the end. I mean,
because then he started out, I don't want to disrespect him, but didn't he start out as a Crip or something? Or he was
62nd Street Crip or something.
Yeah,
not far from where I live now.
Okay. All right. Yeah, you're right. Anytime somebody starts trying to unite people, man, there's if somebody can make money off of that negativity and that beef, that's what ends up happening, man.
Well, listen, look, I can tell you all this. I've got so many more questions that we're going to have to do a round two.
Yeah, if you're cool with that, man. You good?
I am. I'm cool with it.
Okay. All right.
I'm cool with it. Awesome. I love having this conversation, especially, yeah. I mean, look, my whole life now is dedicated to for real slowing the growth of mass incarceration in such a good way and with love. And so anytime we can talk and get perspective, and it's what we do. It's we're human beings. We're part of this tribe. We got to do this. We got to fix this.
Yeah. Right. Yeah,
and we need more police. We need more police. People think we need more. We need more good police officers. We do.
Yeah, I'm with you,
Frank.
Man.
Where can people find you, man?
So I have a podcast on Spotify, The Frank Mink Show. We talk a lot about this stuff. I also talk to a lot about activists. I'm on Twitter. We're getting together a rehab center here where it's going to be for activists because activists are prone to addiction too. So we're trying to get something to build the program to get them sober and say, hey, we still need you alive for your voices. So we're working on some of that stuff, but man, you can find me on, you know, Twitter, Spotify, and, I don't even know. I don't really promote myself.
We'll do it, man. We'll push it. Cause Ski and I both listened to, I believe it was your first episode where Goldie just kind of lets you tell your story.
Yeah.
And I was working out. As a matter of fact, you and I were messaging the other day when I was working out, and I'm just like, it's good, man. It's a good show. So I look forward to hearing more of your episodes, bringing people in and talking to them. I'll tell everybody for the last time, or not the last time, but it's called Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. And man, you can pick it up. I've recommended this book in our police academy when I teach gang courses. I don't teach a lot in the course on skinheads, but I do a whole lot of talking about books to read and what to actually, you know, how to research it. And I always recommend this book, and inevitably people start flipping through it and they're hooked in. And I tell them, read that. It's going to terrify you, but it's also going to tell you there is a way to pull people out of this movement and to potentially destroy the movement. So you don't have to worry about saving people from it. So,
The recovery part I want people to take with this is the recovery part isn't that I might relapse and go back to being a racist, but I can relapse back into low self-esteem, low self-worth, my ego. I can relapse into all those type of other things if I don't stay on point. So I just want people to know, like, when they say recovering skinhead, can he relapse and go back to being a Nazi? No. Man, I would take a brain injury.
And you're cool if people read the book and reach out to you, right?
Absolutely. Reach out. Love helping other human beings. You need my help talking with a friend, whatever. Get a hold of me.
Good deal. I appreciate it, Frank. Thank you for your time, man.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much.
Disruptors out.